Anyway, Dr. Horvath knows all about that regulation. He's going to insist on a council of war before Kutuzov makes a final decision on the ambassador question. I see. Rod fingered the bridge of his nose. Kevin, just who puts you up to coming in here? Horvath? Of course not. I thought of it myself. Renner hesitated. I did have some encouragement, Captain. He waited for Blaine to respond, but got only a blank stare. Renner snorted. I sometimes wonder why the aristocracy isn't extinct. The lot of you seem so stupid sometimes. Why don't you give Sally a call? She's sitting in her cabin with a bleak look and a lot of notes and books she can't get interested in right now. Renner stood abruptly. She could use some cheering up. Sally? Worried about? Jesus Christ, Renner muttered. He turned and strode out. 41. Gift Ship. Lenin moved toward the Crazy Eddy Point at 1.5 G's. So did the gift ship. The gift ship was a streamlined cylinder, swollen at the many-windowed nose, like a minaret riding a fusion flame. Sally Fowler and Chaplain Hardy were highly amused. Nobody else had noticed the clumsy phallicism, or would admit to it. Kutuzov hated the gift ship. The Moti ambassadors could be dealt with simply by following orders, but the gift ship was something else again. It had caught up with Lenin, taken station 3 kilometers away, and broadcast a cheery message, while Lenin's gunners tracked it helplessly. Kutuzov had told himself it couldn't carry a large enough weapon to penetrate Lenin's field. There was a better reason to hate that ship. It was tempting Kutuzov to violate his orders. The MacArthur crewmen volunteers, who went over to test it, were enthusiastic about everything on it. The controls resembled a Navy cutter, but the drive was a standard Moti fusion drive, long, slender stinger guiding a plasma flow at enormous efficiencies. There were other details, all of them valuable. Admiral Lavrenty Kutuzov wanted to take that ship home, and he was afraid to let it get near his command. After the naval officers tested it, the civilians had to go aboard. All this traffic made nonsense of the thin fiction of plague aboard MacArthur, and Kutuzov knew it. But at least he wouldn't have to explain it to any Moti. He didn't intend to communicate with them. Let Horvath read him the expedition orders and demand his council of war. There would be no aliens aboard Lenin while Kutuzov lived. That ship, though. He looked at it floating in his screens as scientific personnel were ferried to it. They'd come to Lenin for the requiem services, and now hurried back to resume their studies of their new toy. Every report showed that it was filled with marvels of enormous value to the Empire. Yet how did he dare take it aboard? It was no good seeking advice. Captain Blaine might have been of help, but no, he was a broken man, doomed to sink deeper into his own failures, useless just when his advice might be needed. Horvath had blind faith in the good intentions of everything Moti. Then there was Berry, with equally blind hatred, despite all the evidence showing that the Motis were friendly and harmless. "Probably they are," Kutuzov said aloud. Horace Berry looked up in surprise. He had been drinking tea with the Admiral on the bridge while they watched the Moti gift ship. The trader shot an inquiring look at the Admiral. "Probably the Motis are friendly, harmless," Kutuzov repeated. "You can't believe that," Berry protested. Kutuzov shrugged. "As I have told the others, what I believe is of no importance. It is my task to maximize information brought back to government. With only this ship, any chance of loss means loss of all information. But that Moti spacecraft would be very valuable, would it not, Your Excellency? What would you pay to the Navy for license to produce ships with that drive?" "I would pay much more to see the Moti threat ended forever," Berry said earnestly. The Admiral was inclined to agree. There were enough problems in the trans-coal sack sector. God only knew how many colonies were revolting. how many of the outies had made common cause against the Empire. Aliens were a complexity the Navy did not need. But still, the technology, the trade possibilities, I should think you would be interested. We can't trust them, Barry said. He was very careful to speak calmly. The Admiral was not impressed with men unable to control their emotions. Barry understood him very well. His own father had been the same way. Admiral, they have killed our midshipmen. Surely you do not believe that fable about re-entry. And they released those monsters on MacArthur and almost succeeded in getting them aboard Lennon. The traitor shuddered imperceptibly. Tiny, glowing eyes. It had been that close. Surely you will not allow these aliens into the Empire. You will not let them board your ship. Mind-reading monsters. Telepathic or not, they read minds. Barry fought to control his desperation. If even Admiral Kuchisov was beginning to believe the alien lies, what chance had the Empire? The new technology would excite the Imperial Traders Association as nothing ever had, and only the Navy had enough influence to overcome the demands for commerce the ITA would make. Beard of the Prophet, something had to be done. I wonder if you are not being unduly influenced by Dr. Horvath? Barry asked politely. The Admiral scowled, and Horace Barry smiled behind his face. Horvath. That was the key. Play Horvath against the Admiral. Someone had to. Anthony Horvath was at that moment feeling very pleased and comfortable, despite the 1.5G acceleration. The gift ship was roomy, and it had studied touches of luxury among its endless marvels. There was the shower, with half a dozen adjustable heads set at different angles, and a molecular sieve to reclaim the water. There were stocks of pre-frozen mochi dinners, which needed only the microwave ovens to make a variety of meals. Even the culinary failures were interesting. There was coffee, synthetic but good, and a well-stocked wine locker. To add to his ease, Lenin and Kuchisov were comfortably distant. Aboard the battleship, everyone was stuffed together like cargo pods in a merchantman, crowded into cabins and sleeping in corridors, while here, Horvath lolled at his ease. He drew the microphone closer and resumed dictating with another sigh of contentment. All was well with the worlds. Much of what the Motis construct has multiple purposes, he told his computer box. This ship is an intelligence test per se, whether or not so intended. The Motis will learn much about our abilities by observing how long it takes our crew to control the drive properly. Their own Browns, I suspect, would have had it working perfectly in an hour, but to be fair, a Brown would have no difficulty concentrating on the telltales for days at a stretch. Humans intelligent enough for such tasks find them excruciatingly boring, and it is our own custom to have crewmen stand watches while their officers remain on call to deal with any problems. We thus respond more slowly and require more personnel to perform tasks that individual Motis find exceedingly simple. The Motis have also told us a great deal about themselves. For example, we employ humans as a backup to automatic systems, although we will often omit the automation in order to give constant employment to humans needed for emergencies, but otherwise superfluous. The Motis appear deficient in computer technology and seldom automate anything. Instead, they employ one or more subspecies as biological computers, and they seem to have an adequate supply of them. This is hardly an option left open for human use. He paused for thought and looked around the cabin. Ah, then there are the statuettes. Horvath lifted one and smiled. He had them arrayed like toy soldiers on the table before him. A dozen Moti figurines of transparent plastic. Internal organs showed through in vivid color and detail. He looked at them again contentedly, then grimaced slightly. These had to be brought back. Actually, he admitted to himself, they didn't. There was nothing special about the plastic, and the statuettes were recorded in every detail. Any good plastic former could be programmed to turn out thousands an hour, the same way these probably were made in the first place. But they were alien, and they were gifts, and he wanted them for his desk, or for the New Scotland Museum. Let Sparta have copies for a change. He could identify most of the forms at a glance. Engineer, mediator, master. The huge porter form, an over-muscled engineer with broad, stubby-fingered hands and big splayed feet, probably a farmer. A tiny watchmaker, damn the brownies, twice damn the admiral who wouldn't let the Moties help with their extermination. There was a small-headed, long-fingered physician. Next to it was the spindly runner, who seemed to be all legs. Horvath spoke to his computer box again. "The runner's head is small, but there is a distinctly bulging forehead. It is my belief that the runner is non-sentient, but has the verbal capacity to memorize and deliver messages. It can probably carry out simple instructions. The runner may have evolved as a specialized message carrier before civilization reached the telephone stage, and is now kept for traditional functions rather than utility. From the brain structure, it becomes fairly clear that the brownie or watchmaker could never have memorized or delivered messages. The parietal lobe is quite undeveloped." That for Kutyusov. These statuettes are extremely detailed. They disassemble like puzzles to reveal internal details. Although we do not yet know the function of most internal organs, we may be sure they divide differently from those of human organs, and it is possible that the Moti's conscious design philosophy of overlapping multiple functions is duplicated in their gross anatomy as well. We have identified the heart and lungs, the latter consisting of two distinct lobes of unequal size. Chaplain Hardy braced himself in the doorway when the ship's acceleration dropped, then surged. After the engineers had steadied it, he came into the lounge and sat quietly without speaking. Horvath waved and continued his dictation. "The only area where the statuettes are vague and undifferentiated is in the reproductive organs." Horvath smiled and winked at the chaplain. He really did feel contented. "The Moties have always been reticent about sex. These statuettes may be educational toys for children. Certainly they were mass-produced. If this is the case, we really must ask the Moties, if we get a chance. It implies that the Moti culture shares some similarities with that of humans." Horvath frowned. Sex education for the young was a periodic thing among humanity. Sometimes it was quite explicit and widespread, and at other periods of history, it was non-existent. In the civilized portions of the Empire, such things were left to books at present. But there were plenty of newly discovered planets where the whole topic was forbidden knowledge to sub-adolescents. "Of course it may be simple efficiency," Horvath continued. "Statuettes made to differentiate the sex organs would require three times as many figurines, a set for the male, another for the female, and a third for the reproductive phase itself. I note that there is a single developed mammary gland on all the forms, and I believe we were told that all Motis can suckle young." He stopped dictating and punched in codes on his computer. Words flowed across the screen. "Yes, and the single working tit is always on the right side, or at least on the side opposite the single heavy work arm. Thus the pups may be held with the strong arm, while the right arms are available for petting and grooming. This is very logical, given the ultra-sensitivity and dense sensory nerve endings in the right hands." He cleared his throat and reached for the brandy snifter, waving at Hardy to help himself. "The single tit on the higher forms argues strongly that multiple birth must be extremely rare among the upper caste Motis. However, litters must be common with the watchmaker caste. At least this must be the case after the creature has produced several offspring. We can be sure that the vestigial tits down the right side of the miniature develop into working organs at some stage of their development. Otherwise, their numbers could not have increased so rapidly aboard MacArthur." He set the box down. "How goes it, David?"
"Fairly well. That Moti toy has me fascinated. It's a game of logic, no question about it, and a very good one at that. One player selects some rule to sort the various objects into categories, and the other players attempt to deduce the rule and prove it. Very interesting. Ah, perhaps Mr. Berry will want to market it.
Hardy shrugged.
The church might buy a few. To train graduate theologians. I doubt if there'd be much mass popular interest. Too tough. He looked at the statuettes and frowned. There seems to be at least one missing form, did you notice?
Horvath nodded.
The non-sentient beast we saw in the zoo. The Motis wouldn't talk about it at all while we were there.
Or afterward, either, Hardy added.
I asked my fiancée, but she kept changing the subject.
Another mystery for future investigation, Horvath said. Although we might do well to avoid the subject in the presence of Motis, we wouldn't want to ask their ambassadors, for example.
He paused invitingly. David Hardy smiled softly, but didn't take the invitation.
Well, Horvath said, you know, there aren't many things the Motis didn't want to talk about. I wonder why they're so shy about that cast. I'm fairly sure the thing wasn't an ancestor of the other Moti forms, not an ape or monkey, so to speak.
Hardy sipped his brandy. It was very good, and he wondered where the Motis had obtained a supply for a model. This was undoubtedly a synthetic, and Hardy thought he could detect the difference, but he had to strain.
Very thoughtful of them to put this aboard.
He sipped again.
Too bad we'll have to leave all this, Horvath said. We're doing all right with the recording, though. Holograms, X-rays, mass densities, Tadon emissions, and anything that comes apart, we take apart and hollow the contents. Commander Sinclair has been very helpful. The Navy can be very helpful sometimes. I wish it were always so.
Hardy shrugged. Have you thought about the problem from the Navy's view? If you guess wrong, you've lost some information. If they guess wrong, they've endangered the race.
Bosh! One planet full of Motis? No matter how advanced they are, there just aren't enough Motis to threaten the Empire. You know that, David.
I suppose, Anthony.
I don't think the Motis are a threat, either. On the other hand, I can't believe they're quite as simple and open as you seem to think. Of course, I've had more time to think about them than you have.
Eh? Horvath prompted.
He liked Chaplain Hardy. The clergyman always had interesting stories and ideas. Of course, he'd be easy to talk to. His profession demanded it, but he wasn't a typical priest, or a typical Navy blockhead, either.
Hardy smiled. I can't perform any of my regular jobs, you know. Linguistic archaeology? I'll never even learn the Moti language. As to the commission the church gave me, I doubt if there's enough evidence to decide anything. Ship's chaplain isn't that time-consuming. What's left but to think about Motis? He grinned again. And contemplate the problems the missionaries will have on the next expedition.
Think the church will send a mission?
Why not?
Certainly no theological objections I can raise.
Probably useless, though.
Hardy chuckled.
I recall a story about missionaries in heaven. They were discussing their former work, and one told of the thousands he'd converted. Another boasted of a whole planet of the fallen, whom he had brought back to the church. Finally, they turned to this little chap at the end of the table and asked him how many souls he'd saved.
One.
Now that story is supposed to illustrate a moral principle, but I can't help thinking that the missions to Mote Prime may produce it in, real life.
David,
Horvath said. There was a note of urgency in his voice.
The church is going to be an important influence on imperial policy regarding Motis, and I'm sure you know that the Cardinal will give great weight to your opinions when he reports to New Rome. Do you realize that what you conclude about Motis will be as influential as, damn it, more influential? More influential than the scientific report, or perhaps even the Navy's.
I'm aware of it.
Hardy was serious.
It's influence I didn't ask for, Anthony. But I'm aware of the situation.
All right. Horvath wasn't a pusher, either. Or tried not to be. Although sometimes he got carried away. Since he'd gone into scientific administration, he'd had to learn to fight for his budgets, though. He sighed deeply and changed tactics. I wish you'd help me with something right now. I'd like to take these statuettes back with us.
Why not wish for the whole ship? Hardy asked.
I do.
He sipped his brandy again and cleared his throat. It was much easier to talk about motis than about imperial policies. "I noticed you were giving rather a lot of attention to the blank areas on the figures," he said mischievously. Horvath frowned.
"I did? Well, perhaps. Perhaps I did."
"You must have spent considerable time thinking about it. Didn't it strike you as odd that that's another area of Moti reticence?"
"Not really."
"It did me. It puzzles me."
Horvath shrugged, then leaned forward to pour more brandy for both of them. "No point in saving it to be abandoned later. They probably think their sex lives are none of our business. How much detail did we give them?"
"Quite a lot. I had a long and happy married life," said Chaplain Hardy. "I may not be an expert on what makes a happy love life, but I know enough to teach Motis all they'll ever need to know. I didn't conceal anything, and I gather Sally Fowler didn't either. After all, they're aliens. We're scarcely tempting them with prurient desire."
Hardy grinned. Horvath did, too. "You have a point, Doctor."
He nodded thoughtfully. "Tell me, David, why did the Admiral insist on blasting the bodies after the funeral?"
"Why, I should have thought that—"
"Ah, yes. And no one protested. We didn't want aliens dissecting our comrades."
"Precisely. Nothing to hide, just squeamish about aliens dissecting dead men. One thing the Tsar and I could agree on. Now, David, could the Motis feel the same way about reproductions of themselves?"
Hardy thought about that for a moment.
"Not impossible, as well you know. Plenty of human societies have felt the same way about, say, photographs. Many still do."
He sipped the brandy again.
"Anthony, I just don't believe it. I don't have anything better to offer, but I don't believe you've put your finger on it. What we need is a long conference with an anthropologist."
"The damned Admiral wouldn't let her come aboard," Horvath growled. But he let the anger pass quickly. "I'll bet she's still fuming."
42. A Bag of Broken Glass. Sally wasn't fuming. She'd exhausted her vocabulary earlier. While Hardy and Horvath and the others merrily explored the alien gifts, she had to be content with holographs and dictated reports. Now she couldn't concentrate. She found she'd read the same paragraph 5 times, and threw the report across the cabin. Damn Rod Blaine. He had no right to snub her like that. He had no right to get her brooding over him either. There was a knock at her stateroom door. She opened it quickly.
"Yes?
Oh. Hello, Mr. Renner."
"Expecting someone else?" Renner asked slyly. "Your face fell a full click when you saw it was me. Not very flattering."
"I'm sorry. No, I wasn't expecting anyone else. Did you say something?"
"No."
"I thought, Mr. Renner, I thought you said extinct."
"Getting any work done?" Renner asked.
He glanced around her cabin. Her desk, usually orderly, was a litter of paper, diagrams, and computer printouts. One of Horvath's reports lay on the steel deck near a bulkhead. Renner twisted his lips into what might have been a half-smile. Sally followed his gaze and blushed.
"Not much," she admitted.
Renner had told her he was going to visit Rod's cabin, and she waited for him to say something. And waited. Finally, she gave up.
"All right. I'm not getting anything done, and how is he?"
"He's a bag of broken glass."
"Oh."
She was taken aback. "Lost his ship. Of course he's in bad shape. Listen, don't let anyone tell you that losing a ship is like losing your wife. It isn't. It's a lot more like seeing your home planet destroyed."
Do you think I can do anything?"
Renner stared at her. "Extinct, I tell you. Of course there's something you can do. You can go hold his hand, for God's sake. Or just sit with him. If he can go on staring at the bulkhead with you in the room, he must have got hit in the firefight."
"Hit? He wasn't wounded."
"Of course not. I mean, he must have got—" "Oh, skip it. Look, just go knock on his door, will you?"
Kevin steered her out into the corridor.
Now, without quite knowing how, she found herself propelled to its end. When she looked puzzled, Renner indicated the door.
I'm going for a drink.
Well, she thought, now merchant captains are telling the aristocracy how to be polite to each other. There was no point in standing in the corridor. She knocked.
Come in.
Sally entered quickly.
Hi,
she said. Oh, boy. He looks awful. And that baggy uniform. Something's got to be done about that.
Busy?
No, I was just thinking about something Mr. Renner said. Did you know that deep down underneath, Kevin Renner really believes in the Empire? She looked around for a chair. No point in waiting for him to invite her. She took a seat.
He's a Navy officer, isn't he?
Oh, yeah. Of course he supports the Empire, or he wouldn't have taken a commission. But, I mean, he really believes we know what we're doing. Amazing.
Don't we?
She asked uncertainly.
Because if we don't, the whole human race is in big trouble.
I remember thinking I did, Rod said. Now this was faintly ridiculous. There had to be a long list of subjects to discuss with the only girl in 10 parsecs before it got to political theory.
You look nice. How do you do it? You must have lost everything.
No, I had my travel kit. Clothes I took to the moat, remember?
Then she couldn't help herself and laughed.
Rod, have you any idea of just how silly you look in Captain Mikhailov's uniform? You two aren't the same size in any dimension.
Whoa, stop it. You will not begin brooding again, Rod Blaine. She made a face.
It took a moment, but she'd won. She knew it when Rod glanced down at the huge pleats he'd tucked in the tunic, so that it wouldn't be quite so much like a tent.
Slowly he grinned. I don't suppose I'll be nominated for the Times' list of best-dressed men at court, will I?
No.
They sat in silence, as she tried to think of something else to say.
Now, blast it, why is it hard to talk to him? Uncle Ben says I talk too much anyway, and here I can't think of a thing to say.
What was it Mr. Renner said?
He reminded me of my duties. I'd forgotten I still had some. But I guess he's right. Life goes on, even for a captain who's lost his ship.
There was more silence, and the air seemed thick and heavy again.
Now what do I say? You'd been with MacArthur a long time, hadn't you?
3 years. 2 as exec, and 1 year as skipper. And now she's gone.
I better not get started on that.
What have you been doing with yourself?
You asked me, remember? I've been studying the data from Moat Prime, and the reports on the gift ship, and thinking of what I can say that will convince the Admiral that we have to take the Moti ambassadors back with us. And we must convince him, Rod. We've just got to. I wish there was something else we could talk about, and there will be lots of time after we leave the Moti system.
And we'll have a lot of it together, too, now that MacArthur's gone.
I wonder. Honestly, am I a little glad my rival's dead? Boy, I better never let him think I even suspect that about myself. Right now, though, Rod, there's so little time, and I haven't any ideas at all.
Blaine fingered the knot on his nose. About time you stopped being the man of sorrows and started acting like the future 12th Marquess, isn't it?
All right, Sally. Let's see what we can come up with. Provided that you let Kelly serve us dinner here.
She smiled broadly.
My lord, you have got yourself a deal.
43. Traitor's Lament. Horace Berry was not a happy man. If MacArthur's crew had been difficult to deal with, Lenin's was an order of magnitude worse. They were Ekaterina's imperial fanatics, and this was a picked crew under an admiral and a captain from their home world. Even the Spartan Brotherhoods would have been easier to influence. Berry knew all this in advance, but there was this damnable urge to dominate and control his environment under all circumstances, and he had almost nothing to work with. His status aboard was more ambiguous than before. Captain Mikhailov and the Admiral knew that he was to remain under Blaine's personal control, not charged with any crime, but not allowed freedom either. Mikhailov had solved the problem by assigning Berry Marine servants and putting Blaine's man Kelly in charge of the Marines. Thus, whenever he left his cabin,
Barry was followed through the ship. He tried to talk to Lenin's crewmen. Few would listen. Perhaps they had heard rumors of what he could offer, and were afraid that MacArthur's Marines would report them. Perhaps they suspected him of treason and hated him.